Get started. Okay, so my name is Shane Hughes from Transition Network, and I'm here with Gunnar Grimson. Gunnar Grimson from Your Priorities
and Citizens Foundation.
And Citizens Foundation. Yeah. Okay. So, do you want to start by giving a quick introduction to who you are and what you've been doing since 2008?
Okay. Like I said, my name is Gunnar Grimson, and since 2008, since the crash, I've been working with my partner and friend Robert Bjarnason on trying to get citizens involved in general issues that sort of should be involved in my opinion, and we're trying to connect the citizens to the authorities. We're trying to open up a channel between those two bodies, because I think in a civil society, in a good society, those people really need to talk together and work together. So that's our main basis. And in order to do that, we created a software which has sort of gone under various names, trying to fix on something, but now it's called, and probably will be for quite a while, Your Priorities. And we've used that both locally here in Iceland and more focused locally here in Reykjavik in Iceland. And we also used it internationally under the name Your Priorities.
Okay, and internationally, have many different places started using it?
Not formally as we do here in Reykjavik. There's been a lot of interest in it from the official bodies, but that sort of seems to very often sort of fall into a bureaucratic red tape wall somewhere along the line. And it's been used quite a lot by different activist groups and interest groups worldwide. But, let me tell you, the basic Catch-22 problem with, I think, all initiatives like this one are that the official bodies won't use it unless there's lots of participations, unless they're convinced that the people want this and are taking part and they can feel the real pressure. On the other hand, the people you'll be hard put to get people to use it unless you have promises on the other end that there's something going to be done with the work that the people are doing in there. So I'm not saying by this that it's impossible to get anything like this across, but this is the biggest problem with this. It's like it's a Catch-22 situation, and from what we've seen, what it needs is either a very positive very sort of people-oriented authorities like we had here and still have here in Reykjavik with the Best Party, or you can have a population that is so angry and that is so that they mobilize even online, even though they don't have any assurance that anything will be done with the work.
Okay, great. So Your Priorities is a real concrete project that's come out of the 2008 crash.
Yeah.
Are there any other positive, concrete things that have come out of that?
You got me at the positive, concrete part of it. I could mention quite a few initiatives that are doing and have been doing a good job. Yeah, actually, one is ALTA, which is Icelandic for WAVE, and they have been doing, we've obviously been focusing on electronic democracy, although we do realize that democracy is not going to be all electronic, but it's just what we do best, and it fit well within our sphere. But they're focusing on real life democracy, people meeting up and democratically finding out the best ways to not only in terms of local-wide or nationwide, but also in terms of working places, democratically run working places, and all kinds of randomly chosen representatives and all kinds of really interesting ideas. And they're approaching it academically. They come from the academic side of the world, whereas we're coming from the practical entrepreneur side of the world. So it's a totally different approach, but with very similar aims. And they've actually had some concrete, concrete. They had some success in getting people to listen to them here. So what you can see now, occasionally in the blog posts or on Facebook or even in the traditional media, what you can see sometimes, you can see popping up suggestions or ideas that are obviously coming from their work. Like we should maybe get people more in control of the places where they work, or it would be a good idea if a part of the representatives were chosen by random and stuff like that, but by a random draw.
Okay.
So you're seeing those ideas popping up. So concrete, no, probably not, but still, to me, it is concrete. If you see what I mean? I can see that it is working.
Yeah, it's like a cultural transition rather than being like a specific project or a
exactly
a building.
And they managed to influence the mindsets of quite a lot of people, both people high up and also amongst the general population. So they're doing some. Definitely doing some stuff.
Okay, so that's great. In terms of, Iceland's very famous for a few things in the alternative media. Mm-hmm. And one of those is the fact of the crowdsourcing of the Constitution, mm-hmm. the documentary, the Pots and Pans, and other solutions. So what's your thoughts on how the crowdsourcing of the Constitution, an update on where we're at with that?
Okay, just to get the end point first, at this point in time, the constitutional work is, depending on how you look at it, either frozen or dead. If I want to be positive, I'd say frozen, but pessimistically I would say it's dead, because
right.
We have a government that is fundamentally opposed to those changes that were suggested in the new constitution proposal. And they don't intend to do anything with it any more than the parliament has been able to do anything with the constitution for the last decades. It's the sort of classical method of freezing the constitution, is getting the parliament to try to do it. But now it's just, there's nobody working on anything concerning it. In terms of how it was done, it's been called a Viki constitution, and that's plainly not true. But it was, they used crowdsourcing, and they, considering their time and monetary restraints, they did it quite well. They used Facebook comments and YouTube and Twitter, and they were just calling, when they threw out new proposals or like proposal for proposals, then they asked, please give us your comments on this and that. And they were used, because you could see the changes, seeing that, oh, well, this is better from that guy somewhere up in the north of Iceland, and they used the stuff coming from the people. So it was definitely crowdsourcing, but it was like, what do you say, manual crowdsourcing, really. It was done by hand. It wasn't like a system where you sort of worked electronically towards the best solution, but it was done by hand, which, like I said, from the time and monetary constraints, that was probably the only way to do it.
Another thing that Iceland's famous for in the alternative media is also, there's this statement that Iceland has one of the best kind of freedoms within the media in the world. I think it's called the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative. What's your sense of where that's at? Do you agree with the statement that Iceland has the freest media in the world?
I wouldn't know, really, because, like I said earlier, I'm not an academic, I'm not a scientist, and in order to be able to answer that question, I would have to, like, dig deep in many... there's data for this somewhere. The main problem is that... I don't think so. But the thing is that the IMMI is another concrete-ish thing coming out of the crash. The concrete part of it was that they managed to get all the parties in parliament to agree on a, what's it called? It's not a law proposal.
Policy?
No, it's not a policy. It's like a statement. I've forgotten the English word for that.
Not legislation.
No, not legislation. It's like a
statement of some commitment.
Something like that, a declaration of what we want to do. And the problem is that those kinds of things are not they don't bind anyone to anything.
Not legally bound.
No,
right.
No. And so it was. It's the easiest way to get something like approved in Parliament. But in general, it has had some weight. It has been something that people thought, oh, well, we really should abide by this.
And do you think that's a direct... This is a direct response to the lack of trust that you've talked about?
Definitely. I mean, from our point of view, one thing we really tend to stress when you're doing interviews and talking to people about this is that although the crash was economic, then I consider that as totally secondary to the fact that the crash was a trust crash.
Okay.
And that's much, much more important than one more economic crash on the road, if you see what I mean. Because that's what happens when you have an economy built on what we have. You get crashes. It's built into the system that you get crashes. Just a question of how big they are and what kind. And so the trust crash is the most important thing. And this was their way of trying to bridge that gap somehow, just the same as we are trying to connect people, because we know that if people start talking together, then there's a good chance that they can find a common ground and start maybe hopefully trusting each other a bit
sure.
more. So the thing is that the IMMI has been in, it's not been asleep, but it hasn't been in full force, like locally here for a while. But from what I hear, that is changing now, and I really have hopes that there will come something more out of it.
Okay.
But at the moment, it hasn't changed anything in terms of legislation or any kind of that stuff. But it has, along with lots of other factors, had some effect in the terms of looking at Snowden, for example, not as a crook, but as a hero, if I paint it with like broad black and white brush, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, again, it comes to cultural kind of changes, attitude changes, which fundamentally you can imagine as being deeper than maybe even policy changes.
Yep.
But at the same time, for those people who are looking for something to say, look, this is successful, and
exactly.
it's difficult to grab something and point to it.
Exactly. So, like I said, I can really sympathize with, there are a lot of people, especially people that were really active in the Boston Pan solution, and that say that nothing has changed.
Yeah.
And I can sympathize with that. Not much really has changed concretely. But one thing that has changed is that, and that's indisputable, is that there are lots and lots of more people that are aware of how the world really ticks around us. And they have totally different views on how they want the world to be, and they have sort of, they don't want it to be the way it was earlier. It's still a minority of the people, but at least it's not like 1% or 0.5%. It's a much higher percentage of people that say, I don't want this, but there's still disillusion. There's lots of apathy, obviously. But the mindset of a lot of people has changed. And no one's going to tell me that is not going to do some, that in the long run that is going to change things, because that's what always happens when mindsets change. So, like I said, I'm not really optimistic. And if my partner Robert was here, I would be really much more pessimistic, because I could trust him to take care of the optimistic part of it. But since he's not, I'm trying to be more balanced.
Brilliant, yeah. Brilliant. Okay, so a third thing that Iceland's famous for is in response to the kind of banking-led crisis, is that the government told the creditors and the IMF that they were not interested in listening to them and didn't want to pay this or didn't, and they supported that the Icelandic government supported the local people and gave debt relief and these kinds of things. What's your sense on that issue?
Easy way to answer that is somewhere like 80% utter bollocks. They were bailing out the banks, they were just doing it in different ways. And, I mean, they just... The funny thing was that the left-wing government that took power here after the crash, not the provisionary short-term left-wing government, but the one that just carried out this full term, it functioned much more like a classical right-wing government. They were really concerned about monetary issues, about keeping the economy running and stuff like that. But they're really lacking behind on humanitarian and human rights and stuff like that. And I've often said that they were the best right-wing government I've ever had. And there's some grain of truth in it, but obviously now that we have the right-wing government we currently have, then you can see how horrible that can get.
So
they're starting to look a bit better. I'm not changing my criticism of them, but they're starting to look much better. And I definitely did not want them replaced with this. The thing is that, we didn't bail out the banks. We didn't focus on the people. Most of that was just talk, both from the government and especially from our extremely opportunistic president. He's been in politics since he was like 20 or something like that, and he was the original Icelandic party sort of jumper. I think he ran for at least three different political parties, if not four. And I'm not talking about like closely related political parties, I'm just jumping across the spectrum and trying to find out where can I get ahead.
Right.
So that's the kind of character he was. And he was known as like, nobody really liked him. He was really brutal and sort of, sort of new political tactics. And then when he ran for president, he just changed his character. And he went into this nice sort of, what's it called, the country father sort of image.
Mm.
And for some reason, probably because Icelanders in general, me too, probably are opportunistic bastards, then still in the last election voted for that same opportunistic bastard to keep on lying to the world about how everything is hunky-dory and wonderful in Iceland, and about how he tried to save the world but only managed to save Iceland, but he's still available if you need someone to save the world, so just go and call him up.
Okay, that's
that's my personal, extremely personal opinion of that guy. And again, if Robert had been here now, he would have probably stopped me one in the head for. But the thing is that just right now he just came back from the UK trying to sell the idea of having like a cable, an underwater cable from Iceland to the UK, selling cheap energy. So he's not only like telling people to come here and plant your bloody factories somewhere here in a beautiful Icelandic country, but please just come and take our electricity just wholesale with an undersea cable that is, I don't know how much it takes in just transferring the energy. I think it's like 30% or 70% of the energy that's totally lost. So it's just about as stupid as a scheme for using our electricity as possible. And he just came back from UK and trying to, like, on, forgotten the news program it was. It was like a famous UK BBC program, and he was just trying to sell his country like you'd sell a cheap whore.
Right.
And so, yeah.
And I bet they loved it.
I'm sure
they're like.
Obviously, that's what
cheap
the news.
Energy.
And the news people obviously love it when they get it. I mean, he's really good. He's flamboyant and he's really good at sort of public speaking, and he's really persuasive. But when you look at what he's saying, really, then you just get what?
Right. So this is another question. Then there's a few things I think a country needs to be resilient to.
Uh-huh.
In the future, and economic crashes is one of them. Maybe we can talk about that quickly in a second, but the energy question for Iceland, being resilient to future energy shocks, peak oil, I don't know if you know much about
peak oil. Yeah, well, a bit.
So I see Iceland having a really unique scenario.
Mm-hmm.
It's both has abundance of cheap energy, but it also is incredibly dependent on cheap oil.
Mm-hmm.
For transport of goods into Iceland and tourists, if oil is not cheap, then Iceland becomes no longer the modern Iceland that it is today.
Mm-hmm.
Also internally, I think transporting people from remote areas and so, how resilient do you see Iceland to future kind of price hikes in oil?
Not any more than probably most of the Western world. The sad thing is, obviously, like you said, that we could, if we had engineered our stuff that way, we could be much, much more self-sufficient in terms of energy. Although the amount of the energy that we have available is not that much when you consider it on a European basis. But if you consider it on an Icelandic basis with 330,000 people, then it's huge, obviously. Yeah. So it just depends on the perspective. But no, I mean, if you do like the hypothetical scenario and say, oh, there's no more oil now, we'd be totally fucked. I mean, there's no infrastructure of dealing with anything without oil. It doesn't matter what you're saying. There's just nothing. There's no train system. All the public transport runs on gasoline or oil. We don't even have... that obviously would use oil too, but we don't even have like shipping around the country like we... I think they just restarted that a couple of years ago, although I didn't notice that much. But they moved it all to the roads because it was much cheaper for the transport companies, but much, much more expensive for the community as a whole.
Right.
So that was one of the remnants of the old laissez-faire government here in Iceland, which sort of managed to ruin quite a lot of things, amongst other, engineer the whole crash in, by being so really free about everything, except the freedom of the people.
So there's another, I mean, the other thing about being resilient then is about economic resilience. And given the crash, if there was another scenario of economic crash or disaster, how resilient do you think Iceland is to that going forward? Have they put in new kind of things in place that make them more resilient going forward?
Not that I know. Probably, most definitely, there have been some changes here and there in the structure of the economy, but no like big ones that I've heard about or even followed. We're not really a country that sort of does long-term planning. We're like a reactive country. We're really good at that. We can like jump up and fix and stuff. And I mean, you often see in Iceland there's a new restaurant or a club being opened, and you drive past the night before, or maybe like 12 hours before, and you look at it and you say, wow, this is going to be open in a month or so. But it opens on time. We just, like...
We get there.
Yeah, we just get there. And there's a saying in Icelandic, þetta rettast, which means this is going to fix itself. And that's what happens. Obviously, it's us that fix it, but we sort of detach from that and say, it's going to fix itself, don't worry. It's going to be fixed. It's going to be okay. And it always is, almost. It's really, really seldom that we don't open something on deadline, you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because it's like Icelandic mentality. Maybe related to the we're like a grown as a fisheries nation, which you had to catch the fish while it was there because you couldn't catch it a month later because no fish at that point in time. So maybe it's like sort of the opportunistic sort of angle comes from this. I don't know. It's a psychology study more than my sort of. So no, I don't think. I don't think there have been any like real changes. There's obviously a lot of those would need to be international anyway, like maybe a Tobin tax or some stuff to sort of slow down this madness where you can just create numbers in the computer and all of a sudden you're really rich. But nothing's really changed actually, and so that kind of stuff we obviously haven't touched and wouldn't maybe do much good. So no, I don't think we've done anything except, well, let's get out of this hole and hope we can avoid the next one.
Right. Okay. I work with the Transition Network, Transition Towns. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of Transition Towns?
No, not until you contacted me. I googled it a bit and it looked interesting, but no.
And so, yeah, then there's... obviously, you're not aware of any Transition Town activity in Iceland. Okay.
No.
So, final question then. Mm-hmm. With your priorities... where would you like to see it going in the future?
Well, like I told you, we're Icelanders. We're not kind of long-term planning people. So I'll just talk about the short-term future. Is that we have a project called the Balkan e-Democracy Startup Project, where we have 12 different projects in 7 Balkan countries, and which are trying to... some of them are... quite like our Better Reykjavik project with like a city scale sort of trying to connect people, but others have different focuses, environmental group, free legal advice, all kinds of stuff that is using our software to try to improve democracy and conditions in the Balkan area. Mm. And this is actually what we're actively looking for funding these days. We don't go the EU way of applying for funds. We're doing this differently. We're doing a crowdfunding, but not only like men on the ground crowdfunding. We're also trying to get like bigger investors interested in this. So in the short-term future, let's say for the next year or so, then this is something that I would really love to see get off the ground. not only because it's an interesting project, but also because of the replication possibilities that are enormous there, because the Balkan countries are really, they're really in a good position to go either in a good way or in a bad way, if you see what I mean. Mm. It's really easy for some of them to sort of, well, it worked really well under Tito, why don't we get just a new dictator and just do it left that way? But the strong resistance to that approach, although everybody there loves Tito, that's the funny thing, they just, oh, it was so good when Tito was here and everything was fine, seriously. And there was, I mean, it was a totally different country from the rest of the Warsaw Pact. I'm not even sure if they were formally. Anyway, they had a totally, they had much more freedom, and on the other hand, they have this brilliant opportunity now to, like, do some real democracy, to put those kind of methods into working in the system on all levels of the community. And the thing is that if, and I mean, I'm not saying if, but when some of these projects become successful, I don't, in my wildest dreams, hope for all 12 of them to be successful, but then what will happen is that it's so easy to replicate them on to another, like, civil society or to another city or another region, whatever it is, because then we'll have people on the ground that have experience from getting it up and running on their end. We have us with our experience in 2008 in doing this kind of thing, and you have other people in the surrounding seeing, hey, this is looking working really well for them.
Let's try it.
So, so this replication part of it is actually what I find most interesting.
Yeah, and it's fundamentally a part of our time, isn't it? Mm-hmm. A lot of networks are appearing at the moment where somebody tries something in one place and it's exciting, and other people say, and it's open source as well, so other people say, let's have a look at this. We can do exactly that, we just do it locally, in our own way.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for your time.
But one thing I was going to say, what was it? Just one mention. I mean, obviously, we believe our software is the best that is in this scenario. But the thing is that we don't have any ambitions or even would want to be the software for anything like that. There's loads of interesting stuff going on everywhere in the world, and it's going to take us quite a few years until we see whom, which of the software is going to, like, succeed on a big scale. And maybe there's just going to be lots of small-scale successes, if you see what I mean, which I think would be even more interesting than if one or two or three softwares would become the world standard for it, because we've sort of done that. Bigger is better. It's not really. It sort of seems to be doomed to fail at some point. So maybe smaller is better, and we should, like, approach it from a bit of a different perspective.
Certainly more resilient, isn't it?
Definitely.
That's one of the key words we look at in transition is building resilience. So Okay. Okay. Thank you so much for your time. It's really appreciated. And thank you for your honesty and your candid views on how Iceland's doing.
You're welcome.